Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill, a special anniversary show being recorded before an audience at the University of Ottawa. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Well, 2015 is going to be a very exciting year in Canadian politics with an election scheduled for October. In the unofficial campaign, the government is championing the battle against terror with a mission in Iraq and new domestic legislation. It's also trying to balance the books and keep its tax promises amid falling oil prices and major job losses. To speak to these issues and the government's plan moving forward, the Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre, is here to sit down with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells.
As parties nominate candidates for the upcoming vote, gender equality is a big issue. Only about a third of the potential MPs in place so far are women, although the campaigns for the three major parties are all being run by women. Cormac speaks with Nancy Peckford, the executive director of Equal Voice.
Leading up to the moment that the ballots are cast, how do the opposition parties plan to knock the Conservative government from power, and what policies or positions are they taking on some major challenges facing our country right now? We'll be joined by New Democrat MP Jean Crowder, as well as Liberal Erwin Cotler, who happens to be McLean's most recent parliamentarian of the year.
And we'll end this show off with a special panel. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes will have a conversation with Paul Wells, and star columnist and author of the book Shopping for Votes, How Politicians Choose Us and We Choose Them, Susan Delacour.
For more of your politics and your power, welcome to The Hill. All right, so this week's show is focused on the upcoming election and the battle plans for the parties as we lead up to the vote that is scheduled for October 19th. We'll start off with the party in power. The Conservative government began this election year with a heavy focus on terrorism. We have the mission in Iraq underway, and as we record this show right now, a new anti-terror bill is being tabled in the House of Commons. It's in response to the two attacks last October, including the one by Michael Zahaf-Bibeau, who, not far from here, shot Corporal Nathan Cirillo at the National War Memorial and then stormed Parliament Hill before being shot down. But many of the government's other plans are being disrupted by the economy. The dollar slipped below 80 cents U.S. Oil is hovering around $45 a barrel, and the Bank of Canada, as well as private banks, have lowered key interest rates as they warn of a downturn during the year ahead. To speak to these issues and the government's plan moving forward, we do have the Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre, and we'll bring him up. He'll be speaking with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells.
As we speak, a new security bill is being tabled in the House of Commons, and the Prime Minister's got an event elsewhere to describe it. It's been probably one of the strangest 6 months or 4 months since you've been on Parliament Hill. What's it been like responding to the shooting of October 22nd, and what can you tell us about this new bill?
Well, as you know, it was a very traumatic experience for all parliamentarians who were there when the shots rung out. This particular bill deals not with the aftermath of a terrorist attack, but with the actions that security and law enforcement can take prior to such an attack occurring. So for example, CSIS under our current legal structure can't disrupt a terrorist attack, even if they have reason to believe that one is coming. They can't even take soft action to try and prevent it from happening. They can just call the police. This bill will allow them to, the CSIS officials, to interrupt attacks where possible. It'll allow authorities to detain individuals who they have reason to believe or reason to suspect are imminently planning to carry out a terrorist attack for 7 days of detention rather than just 3 days. And it will allow government officials who are usually kept separate by privacy legislation to share information with law enforcement that they have obtained in doing their work that suggests an individual is about to carry out a terrorist attack. For example, if someone applies for a passport and the passport official has, based on the information they have collected in the application process, has come to the understanding that this person might be using that passport to go and participate in tourism terrorism, going to join ISIS or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Now there will be express authority for that official to share that information with law enforcement and potentially lead towards prosecution. So these are the kinds of things we're doing before a terrorist attack occurs so that we can prevent it rather than just reacting after the fact.
Would this bill have stopped the murders in Saint-Jean or the shooting in on October 22nd?
Well, that's a hypothetical question, but I think that these kinds of tools certainly would have helped. For example, anyone who was seeking to get a passport, I used that example earlier, and who was rejected from getting that passport because their behavior suggested that they might have been planning to go and carry out jihad in the Middle East. Giving the express legal authority to the passport officer to give that to the RCMP or CSIS could allow the law enforcement to jump in quickly and say, now that we've kept you in our country, we don't want the perverse result to be that we've caused you to do your terrorism here rather than abroad, and so take action ahead of time.
To what extent do you think these questions of security and terrorism and foreign policy more broadly, to what extent do you think that will play in the fall election campaign?
Well, I think it'll play a big role. I'll be blunt about the decision that Canadians face. The question will be whether they want a solid and strong leader who's proven he's willing to take action at home and abroad against terrorism, someone who believes that terrorists are just socially excluded and that we can stop them simply by addressing their exclusion. So we have one party and one party leader who will stand in favor of fighting that terrorist entity, and all the other parties want to stand on the sidelines. So that's a very sharp distinction, and Canadians will have to vote their views on that issue.
The economy receded, shrank a little bit last month, which happens from time to time. It's hardly unheard of. In reaction to that news, the dollar dropped below 80 cents quite markedly. It was at 78 cents when I left to come here. Are we heading into any kind of serious trouble, and is that why the budget is coming out later than it normally does?
Well, it's definitely an uncertain economic environment. There are some positives and negatives to that. I mean, the positives of dropping oil prices, of course, is that it saves thousands of dollars for the average family at the pump. We often look at these things in macroeconomic terms, but if you're a middle-class family in Scarborough or in North Gore, Ontario, you are quite enjoying filling up your Honda Civic for $38 as opposed to paying 60 or 70% more. That's thousands of dollars in the pockets of an average family. But that said, I mean, yesterday Kathleen Wynne even acknowledged the important relationship that Ontario manufacturers have with Western energy producers. And so we have an integrated national economy, and this will hit, these low prices will hit our producers out west and by consequence all Canadians. That's why we need strong, certain leadership in these uncertain economic times.
I believe we've got time for one question from the floor.
Sure.
Does anyone have a question for Pierre Paul Oliver? Phil Lagasse, faculty question.
Yes. Hi there, Phil Lagasse. The Conservative government has made it a point to hold votes in the House of Commons on military deployments. As the Minister for Democratic Reform, do you foresee any plan to make that a requirement in law in the future, or will it simply remain a practice that doesn't necessarily bind the government in any way?
I think that it's something that you do by convention. If you did enact a law requiring it, then a government could ultimately repeal that law. So the convention is probably just as powerful. And I think it's a good convention, regardless of what one thinks of foreign engagements. I think we should all agree that elected officials should have a vote on them when they involve some sort of combat. We reinstated that practice when we took office. And all of the extensions that we did to the Afghan mission followed votes on the floor of the House of Commons. And so I think there's a good political but also public policy rationale for doing it, and I think we should preserve it through a convention.
Thanks for coming, and best of luck with a very busy parliamentary agenda.
Yeah, thanks to everyone for coming. Thank you.
Thank you to Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre, for that conversation with Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells. Gender equality is a major issue in Canadian politics, and some have been fighting decades to fix it. But it's clear we're nowhere close to reaching the equality goal. The 2011 election was a record for the number of women elected, but they still only fill a quarter of the seats in the House of Commons. There's a big push to increase that number in the 2015 vote, and leading that charge is the organization Equal Voice. It was set up in 2001 as a national multi-partisan organization dedicated to electing more women to all levels of political office in Canada. The people who work there have been aiming for more equality in every election since. But will much change after the ballots are cast this year? To speak more about this, Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, will now speak with Nancy Peckford, Executive Director of Equal Voice.
All right, thank you very much for joining us on the show, Nancy.
No problem.
All right, first, I guess we'll start off by going over some of the numbers. A lot of the parties have nominated many candidates in the for the upcoming election. How is it looking right now? How many women candidates do we have?
Right, so when you look at this election, you're looking at just under a third are confirmed candidates, but that's with only two of the parties having completed 60% of the nominations, and the NDP only at 35% of their nominations being complete. So in fact, that number could change significantly one way or another. More importantly, when you look at the breakdown among parties, what you see is that the New Democratic Party is in fact way ahead of the pack, which is what has been the case in the past. They have nominated 40%. For the Liberals, it's 27%, and for the Conservatives, it's 18%. So when you compare those numbers to the previous election, what we see really is more of the same.
Are you seeing the parties actually put on a push that's necessary to get more women involved in politics and running for their parties, or is it just sort of open nomination and that's the way they're leaving it?
Well, the move to open nominations was very significant, and we certainly applauded that at the time. There's no question that that signals to your party base and to women who are watching on the sidelines, who may not be actively involved in the party, and that's partly what you're contending with here. The percentage of Canadians who are involved in the political process is very low. A lot of the women candidates aren't in the fray, if you will, of a party. They're on the outside. They're kind of watching. They show up to a couple of meetings, but they're not necessarily highly attached to a party. So the signal to women who could be candidates was very good when we saw open nominations. But it isn't enough. And what we know is you really have to do active, sustained outreach and investment to women in order to position them well to, in fact, win a contested nomination. And we have seen differences in terms of how parties are talking to women. Is it translating? Unfortunately, at this point, I would have to say not necessarily. Will we see at the end of the day? It could translate into a more significant numbers, maybe, but it's not an assumed.
What do you think of the fact that the three campaign managers for the three major parties are all women? We have Jenny Byrne for the Conservatives, Katie Telford for the Liberals, and Anne McGrath running campaigns for the NDP. So
yeah.
is it a positive sign to see that, that they're in such power positions?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of good news, right? We see tremendously strong women in the House right now on all sides, right? What we know are parties are open to women, and more importantly, Canadians are very open to women. They want to see more women on the ballot. There is no question about that. And the fact that we have campaign directors who are all women, I think, suggests that it is our moment, right? It is the time. But reconciling the opportunity with the mechanics of the political process in Canada is no easy task, and that's where the challenge lies, because it's in the nitty and gritty of a nomination race or the brokering that happens before that nomination race is even announced, where women begin to suss out their possibilities and their opportunities. And I will say one more thing. Obviously, this past fall, we had a conversation that we've never had in Canada about the culture on the Hill. And it was one that Equal Voice has been having for a number of years. We launched a campaign in May called Respect Her, because we were hearing that even though the number of women on the Hill was higher than it ever was, that the level of casual sexism, harassment, wasn't insignificant and wasn't going away. And that's the assumption you would make. But what we know is that Parliament was conceived at a time before women had the right to vote. A lot of the institutional pieces are somewhat anachronistic. For men and women both, work-life balance is very, very challenging on the Hill. So women are looking at all of that on the outside, and they're assessing their own their own desire to be part of that process. And what we hear from candidates all the time is that women want to be productive, they want to be effective, they don't want to waste their time. So when they're looking at a political process, they know, they want to know that they can make a difference.
Is there anybody in the audience that has a question for Nancy Peckford about women in politics today?
It's Helen Morris. Could you tell me what kind of structures and architecture you think could be put in place to encourage more women to become involved, and also who decides?
Do you want to take both questions and I can answer them at once?
Yeah, sure, because we will have to move on to our next guest in a second. So we'll just get your question really quickly, and we'll have to get your answer quick.
Sexism and harassment have become really big issues at the university level. And I'm just wondering, do you think, according to you, we need to find sort of national solutions for these kinds of issues?
So just very quickly on the current structures in place in the House of Commons, many people have been talking about a shortened work week, right? The intention to travel back and forth, particularly when you're a member of a committee, we think should be reconsidered. Could people Skype into a call? Is it absolutely necessary to be in the House of Commons for every vote? There are obviously historical precedents around this, and updating a parliamentary institution is no easy task. But I think either we make a decision as a country that we're satisfied with 25%, because quite frankly, you could stay there, right? Or we open up the doors, we make some key changes that preserve our parliamentary principles, but allow for more people to participate in the process. In terms of sexual harassment, culture of sexism generally, absolutely, we need a national discussion. It doesn't just affect Parliament. It's particularly pronounced in Parliament for a variety of reasons. But no question, if as a country we came up with some, I think, norms and objectives around that, and that's where Parliament could be a leader. They could actually say, we want to model a workplace that everybody can emulate. And I think that's the responsibility of our MPs and the institution generally.
All right, Nancy Peckford with Equal Voice, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much to Nancy Peckford, the Executive Director of Equal Voice, in conversation with our own Cormac McSweeney. Coming up on the show, we discuss the challenges for the opposition during this election year with the NDP's Jean Crowder and Liberal Erwin Kotler. And Susan Delacourt, author of the book Shopping for Votes, sits down for a special Maclean's panel, and we take questions from the audience.
Welcome back to a special one-year anniversary episode of Maclean's on the Hill, recorded before a live audience at the University of Ottawa. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we speak with Liberal MP Erwin Kotler about the GRIT plan for 2015, and we speak with Susan Delacourt, Toronto Star senior writer and author of the book Shopping for Votes. But first, the New Democrats had a major victory in 2011, becoming official opposition for the first time in the federal party's history. It was a big moment for Jack Layton, but tragically short-lived. Following Layton's death, the party elected Thomas Mulcair, who's brought a strong structure to the party, but he has failed to keep his numbers up in the polls, slipping behind both Prime Minister Stephen Harper and the new Liberal leader, Justin Trudeau. Nonetheless, the New Democrats are pushing hard to form the first ever NDP government on the federal level. To talk more about this, Maclean's Associate Editor Aaron Wherry is sitting down with New Democrat Jean Crowder. She was first elected as BC MP in 2004 and has held several portfolios in the NDP shadow cabinet. Take it away, Aaron.
So, Jean, first of all, thanks for being here. This is, I think, a fairly unique election for the NDP because the last election was so unique. How different do you think it is going into this vote compared to previous votes for the NDP?
Yeah, I think it's very different. I mean, I think as you rightly pointed out, in the 2011 election, it was a breakthrough for us. It was the very first time in Canadian history that we were the official opposition. And I, of course, as Cormac pointed out, I was elected in 2004 where we had 19 members of parliament. So we went from 19 members of parliament to official opposition. Just in terms of the current election, I think probably you're well aware of what the polls are saying. We're in third place. And I have to remind people that actually in 2004, if we had had the numbers that we've currently got, the percentage in the polls that we've currently got, we would have been ecstatic. So it's certainly it's a challenge. I'm not pretending that it's not a bit of a daunting number. But we also know that in the 2011 election that we finished second in a significant number of ridings. And so we still have that room to grow. We've had 3.5 years where people have become experienced and done the work in their ridings. And over this last several months, Tom has been out on the road listening to Canadians, and you can see we're starting to unroll our platform in response to what we've been hearing from Canadians about what's important. I also say that, forgive me pollsters, but I'm from British Columbia, and in the last provincial election, they said the New Democrats were going to form government, and guess what? They didn't. So I say that the only poll that really counts is Election Day.
Is it is the major challenge for the NDP still to prove to Canadians that they're a credible fiscal economic manager, that they can, you know, that you can be entrusted with the economy, that you're, you know, a credible party, credible managers in that regard? You know, say what we will about the Liberals or the Conservatives, they still are the only two governments we've ever had. The NDP has never been in federal government. Is that the major challenge? Is that, does the economy and the budget, do those feel like the major challenges going into to October?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it is our challenge that we have to be able to demonstrate to Canadians that we are fiscally responsible. Now, over the last many elections, we've been committed to a balanced budget with our political platform, our policy platform going into an election. Many, many, many of us have served, either have been small business people or have served on municipal councils. I was a municipal councillor previously, and we could not function in a deficit situation. We had to balance our budgets every year. There was just no question. We weren't allowed under provincial legislation to run a deficit budget. Either Stats Canada or the Finance Department a number of years ago did an analysis over a number of years combined of provincial and federal governments. And what of course, it demonstrated was when we had NDP governments provincially, and I'm not saying that we're the same, but we have demonstrated fiscally responsible roots provincially. So I think to write us off in the economic picture is unfortunate because, again, Tom's been out on the road. We're starting to propose some things with regards to economic policy that we think are resonating. Our proposal around the reduction on small business tax, for example, 80% of job creation in this country is to do with small business. So we're starting to take a message to Canadians is that we understand the economy. We've got some proposals for you. We're committed to looking at balanced budgets. So I think that we can make a case for that.
So it's Mike. Jean, you have 40% women in your caucus. Talk to us about if you think that's made a difference in terms of the kind of conversations you have within the party and how the party may have managed certain policy files.
The women are in our caucus have a very strong voice, and you've seen a number of women in very key critic portfolios. Chris Charlton was the natural resources critic. Peggy Nash was the finance critic. Libby Davies was the health critic. And I've had a variety of positions. I was up until recently the Aboriginal Affairs critic. But our leadership has been very conscious of the fact that women need to be seen in strong portfolios. We need to be able to represent the 52% of the population out there who often doesn't have a voice. Is there a lot more work to be done? Absolutely. We're a long way from having a parliamentary system that reflects our population, and I would argue reflects the values in our population as well in terms of gender equality.
I'll just sneak in one more question if I can. You're right, though. It has been interesting to see actual babies in the House as opposed to just people who act like them.
exactly. Well said.
In addition to the economy and fiscal management, is there anything else that you know, you see coming up in this election that's going to be a major issue? You know, we talk periodically about, oh, maybe it's the environment, maybe it's security, maybe it's Aboriginal affairs, which it's never clear whether these are issues that are quite resonating. But do you see any of those issues kind of jumping out and being major issues?
Just with regards to First Nations, I'm going to plug McLean's here just for a moment. They were very brave and daring with that article that was recently published with regards to racism in Winnipeg. And I believe that Aboriginal issues will filter throughout the election because of the impact on a number of court decisions recently on resource development. But as well, there's a number of other ugly racist situations that are cropping up. Campbell River recently on Vancouver Island, a fire in the band office, and some terrible comments written on the walls. The RCMP are saying it's probably a hate crime. There's an investigation undergoing. There's a number of other incidents that are coming up as a result of I would argue, McLean's very bold stance on exposing what can be an ugly underside to Canadians. Many, many, many Canadians, of course, are not like that. But there is this ugly underside that we have to address.
Thanks very much, Jean.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you very much to New Democrat MP Jean Crowder, and we'll switch from one opposition party to the other, and we'll look at the Liberals now. The Liberals, no doubt, in 2011 were decimated. They got brought down to third-party status, the first time the party has ever been in that position in the history of Canada. But a lot has happened since 2011. Of course, Justin Trudeau was elected as a leader, and despite some gaffes, the son of PM Pierre, of course, has held strong, showing a strong showing in the polls and staying on top ahead of both Thomas Mulcair and Prime Minister Stephen Harper. An MP who is seen as sort of a foundation rock for the Liberals is Erwin Kotler. He's been an MP for about 15 years as Justice Minister from 2003 to 2006. He reformed the process for appointing Supreme Court judges. As an opposition MP, of course, he's been respected by all parties, especially for his efforts on raising awareness for human rights issues in Iran and Darfur. He won't be running in this year's election, but he's got an interesting perspective. We're happy to have Mr. Kotler here, and he will be speaking with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Take it away, John.
Thanks. Mr. Kotler, thanks for being here. Really appreciate it. I want to ask you some questions about this year in politics, but just before we get into that, the last time I spoke with you was in the fall, when you had been named Parliamentarian of the Year in a McLean's event. And one thing about that event is that we heard a lot of across party lines support for your selection. A lot of people from other parties voted for you. Could you just say something about the level of partisanship in the House and how you've managed to, at least in some cases, sort of bridge that and be a, you know, it's a rarity in our parliament these days for to think about, you know, coordination, cooperation, and just respect among the parties. What do you think the secret is there?
Well, I think it goes back when I was 11 years old. My father took me to Ottawa, House of Commons, for the first time, and he said, looking at the House of Commons, son, this is Vox Populi. This is the voice of the people. Now, today this would be greeted with a certain, you know, indifferent, if not cynical, reaction. But I always remembered that and took it seriously. So for me, I was, first of all, a parliamentarian. Second of all, a parliamentarian from a political party. And I felt we're here as trustees of the public good. And we are here basically in terms of having to engage in all aspects of our parliamentary role. So I've looked for ways to collaborate across party lines. It's been more easy to do it, if I could use that term, on some foreign policy issues, and more difficult on some of the domestic issues. But I've also felt that the House, since I was first elected, regrettably, has become not so much more partisan, but unduly partisan, a certain incivility in the nature of discourse, a certain lack of mutual respect and recognition. In other words, people don't treat the opposition, I'd say the government turns to the opposition as adversaries, but almost as enemies to be vanquished.
Okay, enough of that nice stuff. Let's get into the election, yeah. Pre-election talk. We just heard from an NDP perspective on what issues might be big this year. Let me give you an open-ended question. What do you see as the issues that might turn the tide in election or make swing voters think twice? Where do you see the change coming?
You know, I was thinking about it, and I was struck by the fact that if we go back about 4 months ago, two things occurred that hadn't even been anticipated and changed the nature of what has been looked at as priorities for the election. For example, at one point, whole issues relating to ISIS and anti-terrorism was something far away. Then we had, of course, the attacks in Quebec City and here in Parliament, and all of a sudden national security, anti-terrorism, emerged as a forefront issue. In fact, today legislation has been tabled in that regard, and I think that I noticed when Prime Minister Harper was speaking about it this week, the kind of logo in front of him was protecting Canadians. So this issue of national security, the cluster, national security, anti-terrorism and the like, may now have more of a prominence in this election than before. The second thing is the economy. I mean, who would have thought 6 months ago that oil would be down to less than $50 a barrel? That has altered the entire approach of the government, and I would say the opposition, in terms of framing economic policy. As we meet today, the dollar went down one more cent, so we're down now some 78 sense. Even with the lower dollar, reports today that, you know, manufacturing is and exports have gone down, and in fact the projected GDP now at 1.9%. So all the economic indicators, you know, have changed, and because of things that we couldn't anticipate. So the first thing is really we don't know what might be some of the intervening factors that may come up in the weeks and months ahead in the run-up to the election. But even if we take these issues, I think what will come up will be issues, you know, about of leadership. How does one address these issues? And as we meet today, you know, there's a federal provincial a meeting of premiers, of first ministers, that's right. And I think one of the disturbing things is that the prime minister is missing in action, and he's been missing in action in these gatherings since 2009. And when the major issues before us, whatever they may be, will clearly involve federal, provincial, municipal relations, will clearly involve federal leadership, that's not a time for the prime minister to be missing in action.
If it's a style of leadership and a kind of an approach that ends up being the question rather than a precise policy issue, how do you think Mr. Trudeau fares in that? I mean, even someone who doesn't really like Prime Minister Harper might find him a resolute, determined, you know, guy who knows his own mind. Justin Trudeau's image is more as a likable, you know, conciliatory guy who listens. Is it possible that he has a liability and that he hasn't yet shown a sort of decisive quality, a kind of, you know, that harder edge of leadership that people sometimes are looking for?
If you balance or measure what in the Prime Minister's case is not so much, in my view, an authoritative style, but very often an authoritarian style, I think that comes across to Canadians in its secretive, dismissive approach. I think that the Canadians want a prime minister who will be engaged, a prime minister who will consult the people, a prime minister who will be transparent. And when you get to the question of whether they'll think Justin Trudeau is decisive enough, well, I have to tell you, he's made a number of decisions which I feel were fairly decisive with regard to his own party. He excluded the liberal senators from our caucus at that time, saying we should now have an independent appointment process. He acted very decisively on the issue of allegations of sexual harassment. I think that he's been very decisive, and he's actually demonstrated leadership.
Mr. Collar, I wish we had more time to go into some of this, but thanks for giving us as much time as you have been able to today. It's great to have you here, as always.
Good to speak with you.
All right, thank you very much. That was Liberal MP Erwin Kotler speaking with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Coming up on the show, we have a special version of the Maclean's panel with a special guest, Susan Delacourt, senior writer for the Toronto Star and author of the book Shopping for Votes. Welcome back to a special one-year anniversary episode of Maclean's on the Hill, recorded before a live audience at the University of Ottawa. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Well, it's now time for the Maclean's panel, and we have a special guest this week. We have Susan Delacourt, senior writer for the Toronto Star, as well as the author of the book Shopping for Votes. And we're going to switch things up from our regular routine. This week, we're going to have John Geddes, the Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, having a conversation with Susan, as well as Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells. Take it away, John.
Great, thanks. The concept here, when we were thinking what to do with the panel, was that Susan and Paul's books have, over the past year and more than a year, in case of Susan's book, have really influenced the way people think about politics on Parliament Hill, I think more than any other books of recent times. Susan, Shopping for Votes, I think, tell me if this is the wrong shorthand, I think it sort of taught us about how political parties increasingly see voters the way companies see consumers. And Paul, I'm going to say, to do shorthand on the longer I'm Prime Minister, that you were kind of showing us the folly in dismissing Stephen Harper's success as some kind of aberration in Canadian politics. Much more to both those books than that. Susan, can I start with you? Your book has a lot of dimensions, but I think one of the most interesting is the way you charted how a few smart conservatives sort of brought a different campaign style back around 2005 into the party. Do you see that style, the sort of micro-targeting of voters, packaging a few promises as something that can be marketed easily during a campaign, as carrying through into the 2015 campaign, or will we see important variations on that theme?
I would have said yes unreservedly, that since it's worked before, they're going to do it again. And then I saw the Ontario election, where I don't think that worked as well. You know, the same recipes, slogans, you know, marketing over debate didn't work in Ontario. And I think given how important Ontario is going to be in this next campaign with the 15 new seats, et cetera, I actually think that we may see, I think it's going to be a real test for marketing style politics.
You made such a strong case for that marketing approach, sort of micro-targeting, figuring out exactly who your consumer slash voter was in your book. Why would it have failed in the Ontario election? Did something change? Is there another strategy that's sort of leapfrogged over it as being more effective?
Well, again, I think we have to wait and see. But what they learned in the United States was that the marketing stuff went so far, and for about 5 years or so, the people who had good consumer knowledge were the ones who were beating everybody else at the polls. But then the behavioral scientists came in, and that marketing turned into sociology. So the next campaign could be a sort of a toss-up between marketing and sociology.
Paul, one of the good things about doing this panel is it gave me an excuse to go back and reread parts of your book, which was such a pleasure. And I was taken in one of your later chapters, you were talking about how the Prime Minister's sort of concept of the role of government and his government's idea about how to budget, budgeting close to the edge, not leaving much in the way of surplus flexibility. In fact, I think you have a good phrase in there, take away the surpluses and you take away the temptation. That seems now to be even more the case than when you were writing the book. How do you see that sort of flavor of things, that tight budgeting as a factor in the 2015, you know, political situation?
So I started talking to senior conservatives in towards the end of 2012, towards the and certainly through 2013, as the Senate scandal got nastier, after the stories about Nigel Wright writing the check for Mike Duffy broke, about how they were going to get out of that. And they said, basically, the back half of the mandate is going to be really interesting because we're going to be able to deliver some targeted benefits that are going to be popular, and we're going to be able to frame this election in such a way that Canadians are going to want to stick with us and not with the other. And I wasn't entirely, they were not entirely forthcoming about how that would happen, and I wasn't entirely clear on it until we got into like the last 4 or 5 months, when it became clear they were essentially going to spend the surplus. So that, first of all, they got credit for spending the surplus, they got all the pop that you get from coming up with attractive tax benefits and so on. But secondly, so the opposition parties couldn't promise to spend the surplus. In the Liberal days, when Paul Martin and John Manley as finance ministers were running $17 billion surpluses from one year to the next, there was room for a really big debate about what are we going to do with all that money. But if you're within a couple billion dollars of budget balance, as I believe a re-elected conservative government would seek to be indefinitely, then there's no room for politics, or there's that you can at least assert that there's no room for politics, that it's a government that is managing things in a very fine way. By fine, I don't mean wonderful, but I mean very kind of close way, on the one hand, and opposition parties that Bolivar would assert, Harper would assert, want to spend like drunken sailors, and we can't afford that. And I think that's, and because of that, and it's turning into a long answer, but because of that, I think a modest deficit, if one were to creep into this year's budget, isn't a huge problem for the Conservatives. Huge, like if the bottom dropped out of the books, that would be awful for the Conservatives. But a small deficit reinforces their case that you can't afford Liberals and New Democrats in government.
Got the two most influential authors in Canadian politics up there. First question's at this mic.
Hi, thanks for coming today. My name is Josh, student here at U Ottawa, and I guess my question is actually something that Gene Crowder brought up about the Maclean's article about racism in Winnipeg and racism in general towards Aboriginals in Canada. And I guess, do you see that at all impacting on the federal scene? I think right now, at least to what I've seen, is not much, but do you see that playing out long-term, or do you see that being more of a short-term thing?
Go.
That's a real good question. One learns to draw a distinction between issues that are important and issues that are salient in the sense that they move votes. Relations of Canadian governments with the First Nations and other Aboriginal populations are huge, but do they move a lot of votes? And that's not always clear. I mean, I think it could become part of a broader narrative of either a conservative argument that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that we simply need to spread prosperity, or an opposition argument, which is becoming stronger with every cent that the dollar drops, that we need to concentrate on people who've been excluded and left out of the main conversation. I have not seen, I don't recall an election in which Aboriginal issues were a big driver of votes.
Can I just a tiny thing, and again, I heard a stat over the weekend. I heard this actually discussed on the weekend, so don't, you may know it better than me, but if 50% of more Aboriginal people voted in the next election than voted last time, there would be a very different result. Mm-hmm. I think some of the parties are out there to persuade Aboriginal people that their votes really do matter, and if they want to change the government, you can imagine which parties are out there doing that. But my understanding is that the Liberals and New Democrats are very aware of that number and are trying to increase turnout at the Aboriginal level.
Fascinating. Why don't we go to the mic over here?
Hi, my name is Jasmine from the Fulcrum. I'm wondering, how do you think student issues are going to play into the next election, if at all?
The most important issue is just like I said, in matters of turnout, you know, that I think a lot of the parties feel burned. They're not discouraged, but I think they feel burned by all the effort they put into trying to get out student and youth vote, and then finding that only a third of them vote.
Susan's right. Every political organizer is keenly aware of the sorts of votes that they can sock away because they're almost certain to have those votes come out, and which votes are dodgier. And one of my first conversations with Justin Trudeau, he said, "I'm popular among the kinds of people who don't vote."
Thanks, Paul. And thanks especially to Susan for being here as a guest. So interesting. And I think that wraps us up.
So that's it for this week's episode, the special one-year anniversary here at the University of Ottawa. Before we go, just want to say a big thanks to all the staff here at the U of O, and especially former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page, who helped us out with this, of course, now teaching here at the U of O. So thank you very much to everybody. Stay tuned next week for more of your politics and power on the Hill.